trying to make sense of massive amounts of complex information. It's the daily reality for so many of us, isn't it?
It really is.
Whether you're wading through, you know, research papers or market trends or scientific data, the sheer volume, the complexity, it can feel overwhelming.
Definitely.
How do you actually look at data that has dozens, maybe even hundreds of interacting factors and actually see what's going on?
Yeah, how do you make it graspable?
Exactly. How do you take something that's inherently difficult, maybe even unintuitive, and make it understandable?
It's a fundamental challenge.
Yeah.
You know, and it goes much deeper than just picking the right chart type in Excel or something.
Right.
Our natural perception, it's rooted in a world of three spatial dimensions. Maybe you add time as a fourth.
Sure.
But so much of the data we generate, the stuff we need to understand, it exists in spaces with way more dimensions than that.
Absolutely. And what's so fascinating about what you've brought us for this deep dive is that this isn't just a modern problem, you know, tied to big data.
Not at all.
You've taken us into the history of exactly this challenge specifically, how we've wrestled with visualizing complex, multidimensional data, especially as computers entered the picture.
That's right. We're really digging into a specific contribution here, a paper from 2015 by the media scholar Shintaro Miyazaki.
Okay.
His paper, it's titled Unanschauliche Datenschwärme, eine medienhistorische Analyse interaktiver Visualisierungen mehrdimensionaler Daten am Computer.
That's quite a title.
It is. It translates roughly to something like unintuitive data swarms, a media historical analysis of interactive visualizations of multidimensional data on the computer.
Unintuitive data swarms. I like that. It really captures the feeling, doesn't it? That sense of being overwhelmed.
It does. And Miyazaki provides this really insightful media historical perspective on this whole ongoing effort to make the unseeable scene, basically. He traces a line from the mid-19th century right up to, well, 2015 when he wrote it.
Okay, so our mission for this deep dive, then, is to unpack this history that Miyazaki presents. Understand the challenges he identifies, these persistent challenges.
Which are still relevant, definitely.
And explore what this whole lineage tells us about how we interact with complex data right now and maybe where things need to go next.
Exactly. We're going to follow the path he lays out. And it starts much earlier than you might think for a story about computers.
Okay, where does he begin?
He takes us back to the mid-19th century. This was a time when the scientific community was getting really interested in visualizing natural phenomena in new ways.
Oh, okay.
Miyazaki describes this period as the early quest for objective visualization.
Objective visualization. Okay, that sounds like they were trying to create images that were seen as pure, unadulterated truth coming straight from the data.
Exactly that. You had key figures emerging then, people like Hermann von Helmholtz.
Famous for his work in physics and physiology.
Right, and his curve diagrams were attempts to visualize physical processes, physiological ones too. And then there was Etienne Jules Marais.
Marais?
Yeah.
The chronophotography guy, motion studies.
Yes, and his book La Méthode Graphique from 1878 was incredibly influential. It was all about using graphic recording methods in fields like physiology, animal locomotion.
Okay.
And the core idea they were pursuing, and Miyazaki highlights this by referencing historians of science like Dastin and Galison, was that these visualizations were, or should be, scientifically objective images.
Objective in what sense, though? What did that mean practically?
Well, they were seen as offering a kind of nonverbal persuasive power. The idea was that they were supposedly resistant to subjective influences, you know, human bias, false beliefs, ideologies.
So the diagram itself was the evidence, not someone's interpretation of it.
That was the goal. It wasn't meant to be an interpretation. It was supposed to be a direct registration of reality.
Kind of like a seismograph making a trace of an earthquake. You see the line wiggle and you believe that's a direct record of the earth moving.
That's a perfect analogy. And the concept behind this was often called inscription.
Inscription. Okay.
Yeah. The idea was that the phenomenon itself, the earthquake, a muscle contracting, changing air pressure, whatever it was, left a direct sort of indexical trace onto a medium.
Like a pen scratching on a rotating drum of paper or a light beam hitting photographic film.
Exactly. The visualization was presented as this automatic output of the physical process itself. It's almost like nature drawing its own picture.
But hang on, even back then, surely they realized it wasn't purely objective. Miyazaki and the scholars he cites point that out, right? These weren't just passive recordings.
No, not at all. And that's a crucial point. It was already understood, or it became clear pretty quickly when you look closely, that these visualizations were always mechanical constructs.
Meaning the machine itself influenced the output.
Absolutely. They were inherently conditioned by the specific media technology used to create them. You know, like the type of paper, the friction of the pen, the clockwork mechanism's accuracy, the sensitivity of the photographic plate, all these things shape the final trace.
So they were representations shaped by the apparatus, not just a raw, unfiltered window onto nature.
Precisely. And recognizing that is really important context for understanding the whole media history that follows, especially when computers get involved.
Okay, so you've got these continuous curves from mechanical inscription machines. They look very persuasive, very objective, even though they were, media conditioned. But then there's data itself, which is fundamentally different. It's discrete, right?
Right. That's a key contrast Miyazaki brings up. Data exists as separate points, numbers, letters, values. It's not that smooth, continuous flow like a pen trace might suggest.
Like census figures or survey results or measurements taken at specific intervals.
Exactly. And data has always been organized in discrete formats. Think of tables and statistics or mathematics or points plotted in geometry.
And could these discrete representations also be persuasive? Did they have that same power?
They definitely held a similar kind of nonverbal persuasive power as the continuous curves, but with a condition, as long as they were easy to grasp and interpret.
So a simple table or a clear scatter plot could be very convincing.
Yes. The challenge arose because data inherently has gaps, right? Jumps between those discrete points. Now, measurement technology was constantly improving, getting faster, more precise,
Yeah.
making the gaps smaller.
But they were still there, fundamentally.
We were still there at some level. Those discontinuities are part of the nature of measured data.
And is that where practices like curve fitting came into the picture to bridge those gaps?
Exactly. Miyazaki mentions this practice, and it dates back surprisingly far. He points to the 18th century, figures like Johann Heinrich Lambert.
Wow, 18th century.
Yeah. And curve fitting is the process, and it's still standard jargon today in stats and computational science of connecting and smoothing out those discrete data points into lines or curves.
Why do that?
Well, you typically do it when you think the gaps are negligible, or maybe when you want to infer or represent a continuous process that you believe underlies those discrete measurements.
So it's a way of making the discrete data look more like those persuasive continuous curves from the inscription machines.
Pretty much. You're acknowledging the gaps exist, but you're choosing to visually represent the underlying trend or pattern as a continuous form.
Okay, so we've got this history, trying to visualize phenomena, dealing with the difference between continuous inscription and discrete data, using techniques like curve fitting to make data fit these familiar visual forms. But the problem that really pushes the story forward, the one Miyazaki focuses on, is dealing with data that goes beyond just two or three dimensions.
That's the core difficulty, the central theme. He uses terms like multidimensionality, high dimensionality, multivariate data, basically interchangeably in the paper.
And this means data where each point isn't just defined by an X, Y, and maybe Z coordinate.
Right, but by many different attributes or variables simultaneously.
Okay.
And he notes that the purely mathematical problem of representing data in spaces beyond 3D was already being tackled by mathematicians from around 1850 onwards.
People like Arthur Cayley, you mentioned, who worked on higher dimensional geometry.
Yes. Cayley, Ludwig Schlaefle, Bernhard Riemann with his incredibly important work on manifolds, Irving Stringham, Victor Schlegel. These were thinkers really pushing the boundaries of how we conceive of space itself.
They were developing the mathematical language for this.
Exactly. They developed rigorous solutions using things like analytic and projective geometry to describe these higher dimensional spaces. Now, Miyazaki is quite clear that his paper isn't a deep dive into the complex history of that math, even though it's foundational.
This focus is different.
His focus is specifically on the interactive visualization of this kind of data using computer graphics. He does briefly mention older approaches to visualizing complex spatial relationships, though.
Like what?
Like Johannes Kepler's amazing mechanical models of celestial bodies from back in the 16th century. These were physical artifacts, models designed to make intricate orbital mechanics visually graspable.
Right, building a physical model feels like a very intuitive way to tackle spatial complexity. But with abstract data, you can't really build a physical model for every single variable, can you?
Precisely, especially when you have dozens or hundreds of variables. And that brings statistics back into the picture even more centrally.
Statistics, originating from statisticum, meaning concerning the state.
Right, formally established in the 18th century to develop methods for handling quantitative information data about populations, resources, economic activity, stuff concerning the state.
And multivariate in statistics today means dealing with multiple variables for each thing you're observing. Like the example Miyazaki uses in the paper, a bank.
Yeah, for a bank, you're not just looking at its turnover. You're also looking at, say, the number of employees, the average employee age, how old the bank itself is, its liquidity, number of branches, maybe their geographic spread. Each of these is a dimension of the data.
Got it.
And the key challenge Miyazaki highlights, the one that really defines the problem his paper addresses, is that if you want to uncover hidden relationships or patterns within that multivariate bank data, maybe trying to see which factors correlate with profit or risk.
Three spatial dimensions just aren't enough.
They're not. You could maybe plot turnover versus employee count on a 2D graph.
Okay.
Maybe you add the bank's age as a third axis for a 3D plot. Fine. But where do you put liquidity? Where does employee age go? You very quickly run out of the dimensions we can easily perceive or plot spatially.
So this is where Miyazaki introduces his central concept for this type of data. He calls it unanschaulich.
Yes, unanschaulich. It's a German word. It doesn't have a single perfect English equivalent that captures all the nuance in this context.
How would you translate it, roughly?
Things like unintuitive, non-visualizable, difficult to grasp directly through intuition or perception.
So these data sets, in their raw, high-dimensional form, you can't just look at them and get it.
Exactly. They can really only be handled symbolically or mathematically. You can describe them with equations, you can process them with algorithms, but you can't readily picture the whole thing in your mind's eye. The overall structure is hidden.
Abstract representation is possible, but intuitive understanding isn't.
Pretty much. And because they are unanschaulich, Miyazaki argues that making this data actually understandable requires special strategies.
Special strategies.
Strategies that are medial or media aesthetic. It's not just about calculating things. It's about finding clever ways to present the data, ways that leverage different media affordances visual, maybe others, to make the unintuitive intuitive, or at least navigable.
Okay, so this sets the stage perfectly for computers to enter the picture. How did the dawn of computerized data processing change this quest to make the unseeable graspable?
Right, that transition really gets going in the mid-20th century, starting late 1940s with the advent of the first large electronic computers.
That must have felt like a seismic shift after centuries of just mechanical calculators or analog devices.
Oh, absolutely. Suddenly you had computational power delivering unprecedented speed for numerical processing. This wasn't just like a small step up.
It was transformative.
It enabled entirely new categories of calculations, simulations, modeling. Things that were simply impossible before. You could process huge amounts of data, run incredibly complex mathematical models that would have taken lifetimes to do by hand.
And Miyazaki argues that this leap in speed, combined with those earlier theoretical innovations in geometry and statistics we talked about,
yes,
it created what he calls an epistemic explosivity for the emerging computer technology.
Epistemic explosivity.
Yes.
Yeah. Meaning it wasn't just faster computing, it was the potential for entirely new kinds of knowledge and understanding to emerge from data.
Yeah.
A potential explosion of insight.
And the output wasn't just limited to text anymore, right? The traditional paper printouts from a typewriter or a line printer.
No. Binary digital data, the raw stuff the computer was churning out, started appearing in alternative forms that really hinted at future possibilities.
Like what? How else could you see or understand what the computer was doing?
Well, on some early cathode ray tubes, the stream of binary data could actually manifest as a dynamic dance of visible points. It was a way to see the state of the computer's memory or the process unfolding.
A sort of visual heartbeat of the machine?
Kind of, yeah. And also, perhaps more surprisingly to us today, the data could be rhythmicized.
Rhythmicized.
Turned into electroacoustically generated sound. Data sonification.
Data as sound. That sounds incredibly unusual from our modern, very visual perspective.
It does now, doesn't it? But Miyazaki points out that data sonification, or Datenverklanglichung, as he calls it in German, was actually a reasonably common practice in certain contexts back in the 1950s.
Wow. So it's like a lost art. Why have most of us barely heard of this?
Well, Miyazaki mentions it largely declined and was pretty much forgotten in the 1960s.
Why? What happened?
There were practical reasons. Apparently, hearing the data effectively required significant practice and skill. It was linked to a kind of implicit knowledge that was hard to teach or document explicitly.
So you needed trained ears, almost.
Yes. And crucially, unlike a visual trace on paper, data sounds were ephemeral. they vanished instantly. They were very hard to store and reproduce in a format you could easily share back then, especially in a scientific world dominated by print publications.
Ah, that makes perfect sense. The medium of communication print dictated the viable form of data representation. If you needed to publish your findings, sound just wasn't going to cut it.
Exactly, which reinforced the move towards the visual. And early visual displays, while present, also started in very basic forms. Take the dynamic memory of the very first stored program electronic computer, the Manchester SM from 1948.
Okay.
Its memory state was obviously made visible on something called a Williams-Kilburn tube. Basically a screen displaying an ordered grid of light points, on or off.
Like a very, very primitive status screen showing what the computer was doing internally.
Precisely. Like the data music idea, it was a dynamic indicator of memory states, computation processes, data transfer. It was a direct visual representation of the machine's internal state. Think of it as a historical ancestor of the invisible RAM states flashing away inside our computers today.
Right.
But then came this pivotal moment. Engineers and scientists realized they could film or photograph these screens.
Turning that fleeting dynamic display into a static, reproducible image.
Which could then be used in publications. Suddenly, these static images, photographs of the screen output, could be incorporated into scientific papers as visualizations of computation results.
So they slotted right into the existing system.
They integrated incredibly rapidly into the already visually dominated sphere of knowledge production. It solidified the preference for graphics because computer graphics, or at least static photographs of them, could be published on paper, unlike dynamic screen displays or, you know, computer music.
So the bias towards the visual, which maybe started with those 19th century inscription machines, got a massive reinforcement from the practicalities of 20th century academic publishing.
There's a powerful feedback loop.
Yeah.
And you start to see early computer graphics experiments emerging in the 1950s based on this. Miyazaki mentions Nils Alberticelli, for instance.
What did he do?
He used the IAS computer at Princeton in 1953 for research on evolutionary processes using cellular automata. His visual results were these static, simple grid arrangements, basically photographs taken directly from the screen images.
Okay. And the oscilloscope, you mentioned earlier it was like the electronic counterpart to mechanical inscription. Did that play a role?
Yes, it did. The oscilloscope was capable of technically precise dynamic graphics much earlier than the first computers, really. It benefited from advances in TV and radar technology going back to the 1920s and 30s. Analog electronic graphics were actually quite advanced by the 1950s. There was a guy, Benjamin Francis Lipovsky, for example, who experimented with creating electronic abstractions on the oscilloscope in the 1950s. He photographed these complex, beautiful dynamic patterns that resembled Lissajous figures, and he published them.
So that showed what electronic systems could do visually, even if it wasn't digital computer graphics yet.
Right. But Miyazaki notes a key limitation here. The actual computer circuits and the binary digital signals of the 1950s were generally just too slow at that point to generate similarly complex dynamic images, especially on the emerging raster screens, which build images pixel by pixel.
Vector graphics were more common then, drawing lines.
Vector was more common initially for computer displays, yeah, but raster eventually became the standard. The point is, the digital computers lagged behind analog electronics in generating complex moving visuals for a while.
So the analog electronic world of oscilloscopes was actually ahead of digital computers in terms of dynamic visual complexity back in the 50s for certain things.
For certain types of display, yes. The real digital breakthrough for generating dynamic, exact digital images came later. It really solidified with the establishment of digital signal processing. And particularly, Miyazaki points to the development of faster multiplication chips around the late 1970s.
Right. You need serious processing power to manipulate all those pixels or vectors quickly enough for fluid motion and complex calculations.
Exactly. And that's when you see many of those older analog electronic inscription machines finally being replaced by interactive digital systems. But, and Miyazaki emphasizes this, while the widespread technology fully arrived in the late 70s, the underlying technological principles for interactive computer graphics had actually been explored much earlier, back in the 1960s.
So the ideas were brewing even when the hardware wasn't quite powerful or cheap enough for everyone yet?
The concepts were definitely being worked on.
Which brings us squarely into the 1960s, a decade that Miyazaki describes as having these distinct, almost separate worlds where computer graphics were developing.
Yes, that's a key part of his analysis for that period.
Right.
Around 1960, he argues, computer image generation was happening primarily in three different largely isolated contexts. Each had its own goals, its own constraints, its own sort of vibe.
Okay, let's unpack those. What was the first one?
First, there was military research. Especially in the USA, obviously, heavily fueled by the Cold War imperative.
Right.
You had areas like ballistics calculation, flight simulation, command and control systems. This context demanded interactive computer systems. They needed graphic displays for monitoring and controlling time-critical data. National security depended on immediate responses.
And the classic example here is?
SAGE. The semi-automatic ground environment air defense system for NORAD. It was this massive pioneering system involving operators sitting at consoles, interacting directly with radar data on screen displays in real time. Hugely influential.
Okay, so military, highly interactive, time critical. Got it. What was the second context?
Civilian industry. Often industries that were closely aligned with the military, like aerospace Boeing, is an example he gives.
What was their interest?
Their main interest was in automating drawing and design processes. This is where computer-aided design, or CAD, really has its roots. It started with things like computer-controlled printing or plotting and moved towards using graphic displays for drafting and engineering drawings.
So industry focused on design and automation, less immediately time-critical in the drawing phase itself compared to air defense.
Right. The speed wasn't measured in milliseconds needed for response, but maybe hours or days for completing a design cycle. It was a different tempo.
Okay. And the third context?
The third was basic scientific research. Here, the primary focus was on using these new computational tools to analyze and visualize data purely for the sake of fundamental discoveries in physics, chemistry, biology, and so on.
So pure science, perhaps less concerned initially with real-time interaction like the military or design automation like industry.
Exactly. Their priorities were different again. And Miyazaki argues, and this is really interesting, that these differing contexts led to distinct time economies.
Time economies.
Yeah, the way time factored into the value and use of the technology. Mm-hmm. And these different time economies, in turn, shaped the resulting media aesthetics in each area.
How did the time economy influence the aesthetics? Can you give an example?
Well, think about the military context again. It needed time-critical responses. Milliseconds, minutes, these were the crucial timescales directly linked to national security. This pressure drove the development of highly responsive interactive systems. An operator had to see updates instantly and be able to manipulate parameters immediately.
Okay.
So the media aesthetic that developed there was all about urgency, clarity for monitoring, immediate visual feedback, and operator control. It really fostered the computer as an interactive medium very early on, blending ideas from like labor science, psychophysics, cybernetics, engineering, mm-hmm. all geared towards creating systems like SAGE, where operators were actively in the loop with dynamic visuals.
So the need for speed and immediate response literally shaped the technology towards interactivity and a certain visual style.
Precisely. Now, contrast that with industry. In design, the visualization and parameterization of designs were generally time uncritical. At least in the same way. You could spend hours refining a technical drawing.
Right.
So the aesthetic that developed there, seen in early examples like those from William A. Fetter at Boeing, who incidentally is often credited with first using the term computer graphics around 1960, was focused more on precision for manufacturing, clarity of representation, often outputting final designs to plotters that drew meticulously on paper. Interaction was less about real-time control and more about setting up the parameters for a static design output.
A different feel entirely. And basic research, what was their time economy and aesthetic?
For basic research, speed wasn't necessarily critical for the insight itself. An insight might come after looking at results for days. However, computation time on those incredibly expensive early computers was a very real economic factor. You didn't want to waste valuable machine hours. So the aesthetics were driven more by the need to accurately represent complex scientific results, often aiming for clarity and detail suitable for eventual publication in journals or reports. Maybe less emphasis on immediate interactivity initially.
Which brings us back to the hardware itself. The actual material basis must have been different for each context, too.
Yes, Miyazaki describes this clearly. Military systems were built around these bespoke interactive systems with integrated CRT display outputs. Industry often used computer-supported design systems that might culminate in curve plotters printing onto paper.
And basic research.
Basic research typically relied on problem-specific large computer systems, very often non-interactive IBM mainframes in those early days, where you submitted batch jobs.
And even in the supposedly advanced 1960s, you're saying paper publications still absolutely dominated academia.
This is a critical point Miyazaki keeps coming back to. Despite the advent of these amazing dynamic displays, particularly in the military sphere, paper remained the primary, the dominant medium for academic communication.
And that had real consequences for how scientists use computers visually.
Huge consequences. It meant that scientists who were using computers to generate dynamic or complex visuals, maybe simulations unfolding on screen, often had to assemble these quite strange hybrid inscription systems just to demonstrate and publish their results.
Hybrid inscription systems.
Yeah, they'd combine bits of film technology, maybe radar components, TV tech, computer interfaces, all cobbled together to capture the ephemera screen images. The persistent culture of those 19th century inscription machines, where the ultimate goal was a stable, reproducible trace, meant the final output still often needed to be something publishable on paper.
So you might have these incredible dynamic visuals happening live on a screen, but to share that discovery with the world, you often had to somehow photograph it or film it and then print stills.
Exactly. IBM, for instance, actually produced a specific device for this. The IBM 740 cathode ray tube output recorder, starting way back in 1954. Its whole purpose was to photograph the fleeting images on a computer screen, making them static and therefore reproducible for printing in reports and journals.
Wow.
Miyazaki gave examples of applications around 1960 where this was absolutely essential. Fields like meteorology, simulating weather patterns, hydrodynamics, modeling fluid flows, crystallography, visualizing molecular structures. These fields dealt with dynamic processes, but the output needed to be static for publication.
It really sounds like they were pushing the technological boundaries of what computers could show while still being fundamentally constrained by the older media format of print.
Precisely. And while science was grappling with this, you also had interesting things happening that drew influence from popular culture media.
Popular culture? How so?
Well, popular culture had its own leading media, then telephone, film, radio, TV. And it's fascinating that some very early, very experimental computer graphics work was happening within organizations deeply involved in popular communication tech. Miyazaki specifically points out Bell Telephone Laboratories.
Bell Labs, the telephone giant.
Yes, but also a massive research institution. And they were experimenting with early computer animation film. He mentions pioneers there like Edward E. Zajac and Kenneth C. Knowlton.
Computer animation back in the early 60s. How on earth did they do that? That sounds incredibly difficult.
It was, by today's standards, a really painstaking process. They would typically enter the program the instructions for the animation using punch cards.
Punch cards, okay.
These went into a big IBM 7090 mainframe computer. The output wasn't visual directly. It was data written onto magnetic tape.
Okay, so tape output.
Then you had to take that magnetic tape to another enormous machine, a Stromberg-Carlson SC4020 microfilm recorder. Miyazaki notes this thing was the size of a wardrobe. Inside it was a special high-resolution CRT called a Karaktron. This machine would read the data from the tape, convert it into images on the CRT screen, and then expose those images one by one as single frames onto 35mm motion picture film.
So let me get this straight. Program, punch cards, huge computer, magnetic tape output, take the tape to an even bigger machine, convert data to images on a special screen inside that machine, then photograph each frame onto film.
That's the workflow. And here's a really crucial detail Miyazaki mentions that highlights the media constraints and the disconnect. There was generally no visual check possible until the film was developed.
You couldn't see what you were making.
Not really. You couldn't watch the animation as it was being generated by the computer. Maybe you could print out a single static frame using a text printer or a plotter to get a rough idea, but you had to wait for the film roll to come back from the processing lab to see if your animation code actually worked as intended.
Wow. That must have made debugging incredibly challenging and slow. It really emphasizes how disconnected the symbolic programming was from the actual visual result back then.
Absolutely. And Miyazaki frames these Knowlton Zajac experiments as a kind of experimental system, really pushing the boundaries of what was technically possible. He connects this work to other colleagues at Bell Labs, too. People like Joseph Kruskal, Roger N. Shepard, Jia Chang, and J. Douglas Carroll.
What were they working on?
They were coming from fields like perception psychology and cognitive science. And they were developing programming tools specifically for statistical visual analysis. particularly a technique called multidimensional scaling, or MDS.
Multidimensional scaling? What's that?
It's a method for taking high-dimensional data, where you have distances or dissimilarities between many items, and trying to represent those relationships visually, usually in a 2D or 3D space, while preserving the original distances or relationships as accurately as possible.
So basically using computers and graphics to help psychologists understand complex relationships in their data by creating a visual map of those relationships.
Exactly. Trying to make complex psychological data structures visible. And this is where Miyazaki introduces a point that becomes really central to his overall thesis about why visualization might be stuck in certain ways today.
Okay, what's the point?
He notes this curious fact about the publications and the films that were produced by this Bell Labs research group working on MDS and related techniques.
Yeah.
The specific hardware configuration they used, the exact computers, the microfilm recorder, the displays, was often not described in much detail, if at all, in their papers or films.
Really? They didn't mention the tools?
Not in detail. Instead, the focus in the publications was overwhelmingly on the abstract problems, the mathematical theories, the geometric approaches, the statistical methods, and later the algorithms they were developing to analyze the psychological data used in the computer.
So the tools themselves, the actual machines and displays that made the visualization possible, were seen as less important or less worth documenting than the abstract methods, the math, and the software logic.
That's the implication Miyazaki draws. He sees this pattern, which he calls hardware forgetfulness.
Hardware forgetfulness.
This de-emphasis on the material conditions, the media specifics of the computing and visualization process, as a really significant historical trend. He links it to the concurrent rise of informatics, or computer science, as a discipline.
How so?
Because informatics also tended to focus heavily on symbolic programming, on high-level languages like Fortran or Algol, which were designed to abstract away the complexities of the specific underlying hardware. The focus was on the logic, the algorithms, not the messy reality of the machines. And according to Miyazaki's thesis, this historical trajectory prioritizing the abstract software and algorithms over the concrete hardware and the media aesthetics involved ultimately led to what he sees as the current software obsession and stagnation in the field of interactive visualization of multidimensional data using computer graphics.
Wow, that's a powerful argument he's making. He's suggesting that some of our current challenges in really getting a grip on complex data might stem, at least in part, from this historical tendency to overlook the physical and media aspects of the whole process, focusing almost exclusively on the computational logic, the software side.
That's the core of his media historical critique of the field, as I read it. He argues that by getting perhaps overly caught up in the elegance of algorithms and the convenience of high-level programming, we might have lost some critical insight or perspective. Insight into how the actual media we use to display and interact with data fundamentally shape our understanding, and perhaps limit it in ways we don't always recognize.
So, despite this developing hardware forgetfulness, the 1970s did see a really significant leap forward, didn't they? Particularly with the development of the PRIM-9 system at SLAC. That seems to have brought interactive exploration to scientific data in a big way.
It absolutely did. As we sort of touched on, visualization in the early 1960s, especially in that basic scientific research context, was often tied to the batch processing limitations of the big IBM computers.
Right. You'd submit your job, wait, get a printout, or maybe some film frames back, hours or days later, no real-time interaction.
Exactly. You couldn't really explore the data dynamically or react immediately based on what you were seeing unfold.
So what changed? How did we get to PRIM-9?
The major change came from what Miyazaki describes quite evocatively as a media technological short circuit.
It's a short circuit.
Yeah, basically a fusion of elements from those different contexts we discussed earlier. Specifically, he points to the fusion of the already interactive military surveillance systems like SAGE with the still largely paper-centric world of scientific computer graphics.
And this fusion, this short circuit, largely happened at MIT.
That's where a key part of it occurred. MIT, of course, was already deeply involved in the military context, having developed the Whirlwind computer specifically for the SAGE air defense system back in the late 1940s. They had the expertise in interactive systems.
Okay.
And a really pivotal event at MIT was Ivan E. Sutherland's groundbreaking 1963 PhD dissertation. The title was Sketchpad, a man-machine graphical communication system.
Ah, Sketchpad, that's legendary. Often cited as one of the very first truly interactive graphics programs.
It really was pioneering stuff. Sutherland programmed it on the TX2 computer, which was an optimized variant of the Whirlwind architecture. Sketchpad is widely seen as a direct precursor to modern CAD systems.
And it used things like a light pen.
Yes, it leveraged hardware that had been developed in that military context, like the light pen, which was already used in Sage, to allow users to actually draw directly on the screen using a graphical interface.
Mm.
It was revolutionary compared to typing in coordinates or using punch cards. It made the design process vastly more intuitive and immediate.
So taking that military-driven interactivity and applying it directly to a civilian design problem.
Precisely. Now, Miyazaki notes that interactive CAD development wasn't only happening at MIT in the early 60s. Similar work was going on simultaneously at other places like Bell Labs, Xerox, IBM, UCLA.
Okay.
But he observes that applying this new form of interactive computer graphics born from synthesizing military interactive tech and civilian design tools, applying it back into basic scientific research for visualizing scientific data, that took a bit longer, about 5 years, he estimates, for it to really take hold in that context.
And that's where the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, comes into the story.
Yes, exactly. SLAC finished building its massive particle accelerator in 1966.
Generating huge amounts of particle collision data.
Vast amounts. So in December 1968, a dedicated team of physicists and computer scientists at SLAC set up something called the Graphic Interpretation Facility, or GIF. Its specific purpose was the graphical interpretation and analysis of this complex particle physics data.
What kind of system did they build for this GIF? What did it involve?
It was pretty sophisticated for its time. It centered around an interactive mini-computer, a Varian 620i. This was connected to a larger IBM System 360 mainframe for the really heavy number crunching.
Okay.
For the actual display, they used a dedicated graphic display system called the IDIM, made by a company called Information Displays, Inc.
Mm.
And importantly, the IDIM used the vector graphics principle that was common then.
So it drew images as lines between points, not as pixels.
Right. Vector graphics could produce very high-resolution lines and smooth shapes, which is often preferred for technical drawings or complex data plots, unlike the blockier raster displays that would become standard later, but were maybe less suited for this specific task at the time.
Okay, so they had this interactive display, but how did they capture the images? Were they still photographing the screen?
Yes. That's another great example of those hybrid inscription systems Miyazaki talked about.
Okay.
To save the ephemeral images flashing on the IDIM screen, they used a high-quality professional 16mm film camera and RiFlex 16M, the kind used in the actual film industry. And they had it synchronized precisely with the display system's refresh rate to capture clear frames without flicker. So they were essentially filming their interactive data exploration sessions for later analysis or sharing.
That's amazing. And they even built a 3D viewer.
They did. They constructed a custom optomechanical viewer so they could look at the resulting 16mm film and perceive a stereoscopic or 3D effect from certain visual encodings they used on the 2D screen.
Yeah.
They were really pushing the boundaries of perception.
A professional film camera, a custom 3D viewer. They were clearly investing extremely heavily in making this complex data visible and understandable. This wasn't cheap.
Absolutely not. This was cutting edge and very expensive technology. Miyazaki mentions the IDIM display console alone cost something like $70,000 USD back then.
Wow.
And the entire GIF facility ran into several million dollars. This was not something every university lab could just decide to build.
So this very sophisticated, expensive setup was directly driven by the sheer volume and complexity of the data pouring out of the particle physics experiments.
Exactly. The amount of computer data was just constantly growing.
Right.
They were still using some analog electronic media for certain measurements alongside the digital systems, but the data explosion was the primary driver demanding new, more efficient methods for statistical analysis and visualization.
And critically, that interactivity, which had been honed in the military SAGE context using those 1960s mini computers, was now being applied directly to scientific data exploration right here at SLAC.
Yes, and not just for visualization. Miyazaki gives another example at SLAC. They used interactive digital control systems in the beam switchyard, where they directed the particle beams.
How did that help?
It eliminated the delays and potential human communication errors that used to happen when people in spatially separated buildings had to coordinate these complex switching processes manually or over intercoms. It shows that interactivity wasn't just about looking at data. It was fundamentally changing scientific workflows, making them faster and more reliable.
But the amazing hardware and the physical setup alone weren't sufficient, right? They also needed new software to actually drive this thing and make it usable.
Correct. Hardware is only half the battle. To make interactive graphics programming easier and, crucially, to open up this expensive facility to more researchers in different kinds of projects, they had to develop new software packages and also simplified programming languages, specifically tailored to the GIF system and its interactive capabilities.
And all of this, the hardware, the software development, the need for better analysis tools, laid the perfect groundwork for John Wilder Tunkey's pivotal visit in 1972.
Absolutely. Tunkey was, a giant in the field of statistics. A professor at Princeton.
Coined the term BIT.
Coined BIT.
Yeah.
Was one of the first to use software in its modern sense. Co-developed the fast Fourier transform algorithm.
Which is fundamental in signal processing.
Hugely important. And he also founded the whole field of exploratory data analysis, or EDA.
What's the core idea of EDA?
ED emphasizes using statistical methods, especially graphical methods, to really explore and uncover patterns in data, rather than just using stats to confirm pre-existing hypotheses. It's about letting the data speak visually. And Tunkey had been interested in using computers for data visualization since the early 1960s.
And his visit to SLAC, that four-month visit, was arranged by William F. Miller, who was head of the computational research group there.
That's right. Tunkey spent 4 months at SLAC in the spring of 1972. And Miyazaki considers this visit a truly catalytic event in the media history of data visualization. Why? Because it directly led to the development of a real landmark system.
The birth of Prim9.
Exactly. During that relatively short visit, Tunkey, working very closely with Marianne Fisher Keller and Jerome H. Friedman, who were already part of Miller's group at SLSC and knew the GIF hardware and software inside out, they developed the interactive visualization program they called Prim9.
And its specific purpose was?
It was designed explicitly for the exploratory analysis of those incredibly complex, multidimensional data sets coming directly from the particle accelerator collision experiments at SLAC. Miyazaki calls Prim9 zukunftsweisend, pioneering, future-oriented, and it absolutely was.
How was it documented? Can we still see what it did?
Yes, thankfully. There's a fascinating 1973 film demonstrating its capabilities in action, and also a detailed 1974 technical report. Miyazaki actually quotes from the report, and the description gives you a really clear sense of what made Prim9 so advanced for its time.
What did the report say?
It said Prim9 is an interactive data display and analysis system for the examination and dissection of multidimensional data. It allows the user to manipulate and viewpoint sets in up to 9 dimensions.
9 dimensions, okay.
This is accomplished by providing all 36 two-dimensional projections along the original axis at the push of a button, along with the ability to rotate the data to any desired orientation. These rotations are performed in real time and in a continuous manner under operator control.
Manipulate and viewpoint sets in up to 9 dimensions. In real time. Continuous manner. Under operator control. That must have been absolutely astonishing for researchers who were used to submitting batch jobs and waiting hours for static printouts.
It was a fundamental shift in the entire experience of interacting with complex data.
Correct.
Prim9 allowed you to do interactive projection, taking that high-dimensional data cloud and projecting it down onto the 2D screen.
Okay.
Then you could continuously rotate those 2D projections in real time, smoothly exploring different viewpoints to see if structures emerged. You could isolate specific subsets of the data points, maybe draw a boundary around a cluster you suspected. You could mask out certain points, or even filter out entire dimensions to simplify the view.
All interactively.
All interactively. The user was performing manual exploration, which Tunkey and his colleagues termed projection pursuit. You were actively pursuing interesting projections by manipulating the view, guided by your own intuition and what you were seeing.
And
the goal was image-based differentiation, basically.
Yeah.
Using the visual output on the screen to distinguish meaningful clusters or groups within that complex, high-dimensional data set. And crucially, you could also save intermediate visualization results.
Ah, so you could dynamically explore, maybe find an interesting angle on the data, isolate a potential cluster, save that specific view or state, and then continue searching from there or come back to it later. It really turned data analysis into a form of interactive visual exploration.
Exactly. And it was that high level of interactivity combined with its genuinely advanced analytical methods for navigating high-dimensional spaces that gave Prim9 such a significant influence on the developing culture and technology of interactive data visualization.
Did any software ideas come out of it too?
Yes. Miyazaki also notes something important. While they were developing Prem9, Dookie and Friedman also experimented with automatic methods for projection pursuit. Essentially, algorithms that would try to automatically search for statistically interesting 2D projections without needing constant manual control. And this experimental work on automatic projection pursuit was later picked up by others in the 1980s and eventually became a standard feature in many statistical visualization software packages.
So Prem9 wasn't just a technological marvel, it was conceptually groundbreaking, demonstrating the immense power of putting the human analyst directly in the loop with a responsive computational and graphical system to tackle those inherently unanalyzed datasets.
It was a major, major milestone, no question. Now, if we fast forward about 3 decades from that Prem9 technical report, so we're moving into the early 2000s.
Okay.
We arrive at the emergence of a field explicitly calling itself visual analytics.
Right. Miyazaki marks a specific point for this emergence, doesn't he? A special issue of the journal Computer Graphics in the fall of 2004, dedicated entirely to visual analytics.
Yes, exactly. This issue really celebrated visual analytics as a new, important, interdisciplinary field. And by this time, things had changed dramatically since the Prem9 days.
How was that?
Well, thanks to much lower production costs for hardware, the incredible miniaturization of electronics, and of course, the widespread rise of the personal computer throughout the last quarter of the 20th century. Interactive data visualization had spread far beyond those incredibly expensive government-funded labs like SLAC.
It became much more accessible, moving into university life science labs, financial analysis departments, and as Miyazaki notes, even eventually reaching the desks of historians using quantitative methods.
Exactly. The tools became democratized, at least to some extent. And how is this newly labeled field of visual analytics defined? Miyazaki quotes the guest editors of that 2004 special issue, Wong and Thomas.
What was their definition?
They described visual analytics as a contemporary and proven approach to combine the art of human intuition and the science of mathematical deduction to directly perceive patterns and derive knowledge and insight from them.
That definition sounds very much like the goal of Prem9, doesn't it? Combining computational power with human perception and intuition.
It really does echo that core idea. And Miyazaki acknowledges that since the Prem9 era, there have been significant progress in the tools and techniques available.
Like what?
Well, other display forms have been developed and popularized, like parallel coordinates.
Can you briefly explain parallel coordinate?
Sure. It's a method for plotting high-dimensional data where instead of orthogonal axes like X, Y, Z, you draw each dimension as a separate parallel vertical line. Then a single data point, which has a value for each dimension, is shown as a polygonal chain, a line that zigzags across all the parallel axes, intersecting each axis at the value corresponding to that dimension for that data point.
Okay, so you can see patterns in how the lines cluster or cross.
Exactly. It's another way to try and visualize high-dimensional relationships. So things like parallel coordinates were developed, and older, more traditional visualization types like pie charts, maps, network diagrams, they were optimized, extended, made interactive.
So the toolbox of visualization methods definitely grew and improved over those decades.
Yes, it absolutely did. But Tethys, and this is a really critical point that Miyazaki makes, leading into his critique, he argues that the underlying principle of knowledge production, the reliance on Augenarbeit or iWork, hasn't fundamentally changed.
Still primarily visual.
Yes. Despite all the technical advances, the primary reliance has remained overwhelmingly on visual perception. He contends that scientists, engineers, mathematicians, while constantly improving the tools, have rarely, if ever, seriously questioned the fundamental usefulness or the primacy of relying mainly on sight to understand complex data.
So while the techniques got better, faster, more interactive, the core sensory mode for understanding the data remained almost exclusively visual. That was taken as a given.
Precisely. And Miyazaki explains where the focus of optimization really lay during this period between, say, Prem9 and the rise of visual analytics. It wasn't primarily on developing fundamentally new visualization methods based on different principles or exploring radically different media aesthetics for representing data.
Where was the focus then?
Instead, the optimization happened largely on the hardware and software systems themselves, making things faster, more efficient. Technical processes like data analysis pipelines, exploration workflows, evaluation methods, the visualization rendering itself, these were constantly improved for speed and efficiency.
Moore's Law in action.
Right. Computers became vastly more powerful. They got networked. Processing became parallelized. New algorithms were written to handle bigger data sets. Old algorithms were optimized for performance on the new hardware.
And all of this was happening while the amount of data being generated just exploded exponentially across almost every field.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Massive, truly unprecedented amounts of data were being generated. And this brings Miyazaki right back to what he sees as the persistent and, in his view, largely unsolved problem. The dynamic interactive images produced by what he calls computational sciences got bigger, sharper, rendered faster. They became more accurate, far more complex visually. But T, the fundamental problem of the unintuitiveness, the Unanschaulichkeit of those high-dimensional data sets that remained essentially unsolved, especially because these data sets were now being produced in such overwhelming quantities.
His point is that just throwing more data or faster processing or higher resolution graphics at an inherently unintuitive high-dimensional problem doesn't automatically make it intuitive.
Exactly. You can make the picture prettier or faster, but if the underlying representation doesn't map well to human intuition for high-dimensional structures, you hit a wall.
So even with incredibly fast computers, brilliant algorithms, and sophisticated interactive graphics, we're still fundamentally struggling to make intuitive sense of these vast, complex data swarms using primarily our eyes.
That's the state of the challenge, as Miyazaki describes it, leading up to his writing in 2015.
Mm.
And this persistent struggle, this feeling that maybe we've hit a plateau despite technological progress, leads him directly to his concluding thoughts on data aesthetics and potential future possibilities. He wants to suggest a path forward based on the historical analysis he's just laid out.
Right. He's not just giving us a history lesson for its own sake. He's explicitly using that history to try and point towards potential solutions or different ways of thinking.
Exactly. He reiterates that his purpose in blending the media history with informatics isn't just about, you know, analyzing the past or showing the technological genealogy of visual analytics. It's about trying to provoke new syntheses.
New synthesis.
New ways of thinking in a historically informed design practice, specifically for knowledge production. Ideas that can then be discussed, negotiated, and perhaps implemented within the sciences themselves. Acknowledging, of course, that scientific practices are always conditioned by their media and historical circumstances, even if scientists don't always reflect on that.
Okay. And what does his historical analysis suggest is a promising but perhaps overlooked direction for these new syntheses? Where should we be looking?
Well, he starts by restating the current limitation very clearly. Many existing visualization methods, he argues, are reaching the limits of the visual complexity that we humans can effectively process, at least from a knowledge design perspective, from a media aesthetic perspective.
There's only so much information we can meaningfully extract from even the most sophisticated visual display before it just becomes overwhelming noise or clutter.
Pretty much. We hit cognitive limits. And then he reminds us that his media historical analysis, especially when looking back at those very early computer experiments around 1950, actually highlighted a significant failure or perhaps a neglect of alternative forms of data aestheticization.
Right, the path's not taken.
Specifically, the historical neglect and eventual forgetting of data sonification. He argues that we as a scientific and technological culture failed to properly cultivate sound as a complementary modality for data understanding.
And he briefly touches on the reasons for that failure in the paper, the historical reasons why sonification didn't catch on like visualization did.
Yes, he points to two main interconnected reasons, rooted deeply in the history and the culture of knowledge production. First, he argues that empirical sciences, traditionally, tend not to engage deeply with their own history or with the aesthetics of their tools and methods.
They focus on the subject matter, not the process.
Largely, yes. They focus intensely on the content problems of their specific subject, particle physics, molecular biology, economics, whatever it is, not usually on reflecting on the history or the foundational media aesthetics of the experimental systems or computational systems they use to study that subject. Evaluating these foundational aspects, questioning why they use certain media or methods, hasn't typically been part of their core research agenda.
So maybe they weren't systematically pausing to ask critical questions like, why are we so incredibly focused on seeing this data? Or what might we gain if we tried to hear it instead or in addition?
Not in a widespread, systematic, reflexive way, according to Miyazaki's perspective. It wasn't prioritized. And the second major reason, which we've touched on several times now because it's so central, the centuries-long dominance of paper and printed publication as the primary medium for scientific communication.
Which strongly favored the visual.
Overwhelmingly. Scientific knowledge production, deeply constrained by the practical need to publish findings in print journals to get credit and disseminate results, simply lacked the institutional means and perhaps the cultural impetus to seriously cultivate alternative modalities like sound-based process analysis as a standard valued practice.
Because as you said, you could publish a photograph of a computer graphic or a chart drawn by a plotter, but you couldn't easily publish computer music or the sound of a simulation. The output had to be renderable as static marks on paper to fit into the established system.
That powerful bias, shaped by the affordances and limitations of the prevailing media format, played a huge role in sidelining non-visual approaches like sonification for a very long time. However, Miyazaki notes near the end of his paper, the media landscape is changing significantly.
Right. The rise of digital publication must be a major factor here.
Absolutely. The spread and the increasing acceptance of academic online publications, really taking off since the 1990s, offers entirely new possibilities. He even cites data from 2004 showing that already by then, 80% of peer-reviewed scientific journals were available digitally online. This fundamental shift changes what can be shared, archived, and evaluated by the scientific community.
And now, with much better digitalization and standardization of audiovisual formats online, you do occasionally see things like film clips, animations, or even sound files being included as supplementary materials alongside traditional papers, even in top journals like Science or Nature.
Yes. It's maybe not yet fully integrated into the core argumentative structure of papers in most fields, but the technical barriers to sharing and accessing non-print media have lowered dramatically. And relatedly, he also points to the democratization of digital creative tools, which has led to new study programs emerging in art schools and design schools, specifically focused on things like data visualization, interaction design, and maybe even data art.
Suggesting that new perspectives, maybe more attuned to aesthetics and different sensory modalities, might be entering the field from outside the traditional scientific disciplines.
That's the hope, perhaps. So, given these changes in the media landscape, and drawing on the historical context he's established, what's the concrete way forward that Miyazaki proposes at the end?
What's his suggestion?
He suggests that a media and knowledge historically informed design practice, one that actually understands this history we've been discussing,
right,
and is genuinely interested in supporting current scientific knowledge production, could explore what he terms a complementary data aesthetics.
Complementary. Okay, so not about replacing visualization entirely.
No, not replacing it, but adding to it. He envisions an approach that deliberately combines visualization with sonification, giving sound a strong, carefully designed, integrated role as an alternative or supplementary perception modality alongside the visual.
Using our ears in addition to our eyes to try and make sense of complex data.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of intuitive sense, actually, when you think about how overwhelming purely visual information can become, especially with these massive high-dimensional data sets. Sound can convey different kinds of information, maybe overall trends, outliers, changes over time simultaneously, or in ways that are less likely to just create visual clutter.
Precisely. Sound has different strengths.
Mm.
And Miyazaki argues that developing this kind of complementary approach seriously would require dedicated research into the history of data sonification itself, a history that, as we noted, has been largely forgotten or marginalized. We need to understand its past successes and failures in parallel with the well-studied history of visualization.
Because if we don't understand its past, why it perhaps failed to gain traction before, we can't understand how it might succeed now under different technological and cultural conditions.
Right. And the final step he proposes is to take these historical findings, both from visualization and sonification history, and integrate them back into experimental knowledge design.
What does that mean practically?
It means open-ended creation. Building new kinds of audiovisual software applications, maybe interactive media installations, or other kinds of open systems that are specifically designed for exploring complex data, using both sight and sound working together in concert, experimenting with how to best combine them.
This really raises a fascinating and important question then, doesn't it? Given the very real limits of what we can effectively process visually, especially with these modern data swarms of unprecedented size and complexity, and acknowledging this deep historical bias towards seeing, what might we actually gain, or perhaps more pointedly, what crucial insights might we currently be missing by not engaging our other senses, like hearing much more fully and systematically in our quest to understand the complex world that all this data is trying to show us?
It's the provocative and I think very timely question that Miyazaki leaves us with. The history he traces shows us very clearly how our media technologies shaped our approach to understanding data. The present situation shows us the potential limitations of sticking so rigidly to just one primary sensory channel when faced with overwhelming informational complexity. Perhaps the future of truly understanding data lies, at least partly, in reclaiming, reimagining, and integrating those methods and modalities that we historically sidelined or forgot.
So looking back at this incredible historical journey presented by Miyazaki, starting way back with that 19th century quest for objective inscription, grappling with discrete data points versus continuous curves.
Then moving through those different, almost parallel worlds of early computer graphics development in the military, industry, and basic science.
Leading to the breakthrough of truly interactive exploration with systems like PRIM-9, which finally let analysts directly manipulate and visually interrogate high-dimensional data.
Right up to the current state of visual analytics, which, despite all of the computational and graphical power we now have, is arguably still struggling with the fundamental unintuitiveness, the unentschuldigkeit of massive multidimensional datasets.
The core challenge identified in the paper really does seem to persist, making this inherently difficult to grasp multidimensional data truly understandable, intuitively graspable.
It's still the central problem.
And the paper makes a really compelling case that the specific historical path we took, one that was heavily biased towards visual representation, partly, maybe largely, due to the centuries-long dominance of print media, may have inadvertently caused us to neglect other potentially powerful sensory modalities, especially sound, in the design of our tools for data exploration and understanding.
Leaving us potentially with a significant blind spot, or maybe a deaf spot, in our ability to perceive patterns in data.
So the final thought for you, our listener, to mull over is this. Given the very real limits of what our eyes and brains can visually process, especially when faced with these data swarms of unprecedented size and dimensionality, what might we gain? What new insights might we unlock? Or what crucial patterns might we currently be missing entirely by not engaging our other senses, particularly our sense of hearing, much more fully and thoughtfully in our ongoing quest to understand the incredibly complex world that all this data is trying to show us? It's a question that really makes you think about the future of how we interact with and make sense of information itself.